Welcome to this KQED Public Radio Public Affairs Special. I'm Joshua Johnson. On October 14, 2014, the Computer History Museum presented The Innovators, how a group of hackers, geniuses, and geeks created the digital revolution, and a conversation with its author, Walter Isaacson. Here to introduce and speak with Walter Isaacson is John Holler, President and CEO of the Computer History Museum.
The history of computing is epic. It is the ongoing story of how one of the greatest periods of creativity in human history has been unleashed. It is populated with some of the most fascinating people of our time. And now one of the most distinguished biographers of our time has taken it on and produced an exceptional result. The biographer, of course, is Walter Isaacson, not content solely with his award-winning, best-selling biographies of Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, and Steve Jobs. Walter has returned once more to paint on a very large canvas, and the book is The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. And all of us have learned and are delighted to have learned in the process that Walter Isaacson has an inner geek, and he has tapped into it directly. The epic stories are all here: Alan Turing, Bob Noyce, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Mark Andreessen, and more. But he also weaves a very skillful story about the lesser-known icons of computing, the women who programmed the ENIAC, for example, the hackers and rebels behind the first online communities, the obscure Belgian engineer who helped Tim Berners-Lee give rise to the World Wide Web. He even sorts out the real story behind Al Gore and the Internet. Walter will take us on an abbreviated journey through that story tonight, starting with the distant figures, but very important figures, of Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace. Please join me in welcoming Walter Isaacson.
Thank you, John.
Welcome back.
It's great to be back, and this is an amazingly wonderful place. So it's such an honor to be back here, and you can even reveal my inner geek if you need to.
I think you're about to do that yourself.
You know, I grew up soldering ham radios, and my dad was an electrical engineer, and my uncles, and I love circuit boards, so it was good to get back and write about them.
Is that how you originally got into this? Did you develop a kind of fascination with that kind of technology even before you knew what you wanted to do?
You know, one of the things I think you learn as a biographer is it's partly about pleasing Dad. My dad was an electrical engineer, and he made me understand, you know, how a transistor, a capacitor, a resistor works, how you make a circuit. And I was so fascinated by that, I just wanted to sort of convey that excitement. And most people in this room probably remember opening things up, testing the tubes in your radio, figuring out how to make a circuit. But nowadays, I fear that our devices are so closed up that we don't get that hands-on feel and excitement, you know, that I had growing up. And then I was in charge of digital media for Time Incorporated. And at one point, my boss asked, I won't say his name since we're on TV, said, well, who owns the Internet? And I said, well, you know, to myself, that's a clueless question. And they said, well, who, you know, how did it come to be? Who built it? And I thought, that's clueless. And then I realized I did not know the answer to that. And I thought it'd be really interesting to figure out who were the people who did the Internet. And then when I interviewed Bill Gates about it, one of the lucky things about being at Time is you get to meet all these people. So he said, yes, but the intersection of the Internet with the personal computer, that's like the steam engine and the mills intersecting during the Industrial Revolution. You want to do both those stories. And so I realized that we have lots of books about the Industrial Revolution or the Scientific Revolution or even the French Revolution, the American Revolution, but we don't know who's the Paul Revere, you know, of the Digital Revolution, even though we live it every day.
What was your inspiration for beginning where you begin? Because you go back to the roots of computing, which we love, of course, because we have the Babbage engine downstairs, but you go back to Babbage and Lovelace.
There's part of the Babbage engine.
And there's part of the Babbage engine right there.
Well, as long as I'm embarrassing every member of my family, my daughter was supposed to be writing her entrance essay to go to college, and being the type of family that we are, we thought, you know, parents are supposed to be involved in this process. She thought to the contrary, and so was not even talking to us about it. My wife was getting a little jittery, like, why haven't you written it? And finally she said, well, I've written it and I've done it and sent it in. And I said, who was it on? Or what was it on, I said. And she said, Ada Lovelace. Now, I actually did know who Ada Lovelace was, but I couldn't remember what was it that she did that really helped define the digital and computer revolution. And so Betsy, my daughter, got me very turned on to Ada Lovelace, and I was already writing this book. I've been working on it off and on for 15 years, but I needed some frame for it. And the more I studied Ada, the Countess of Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, and her partnership with Charles Babbage, the more I realized, oh, that's a great framing device of the connection of the humanities and poetry to processors and engineering. And you remember when I was here, I was talking about Steve Jobs, and I think we even showed it, but at every one of his product launches, he had that intersection of the liberal arts and technology, or the liberal arts and sciences. And that's what Ada Lovelace was, you know, with her father being a romantic poet and her mother being a mathematician. She helped create that intersection, which is where the true creativity, I think, happens in the digital age.
There's a thesis in this book, as you begin that story, that I just want to spin out so that everyone understands, at least this is the passage I picked out. You wrote, the key to innovation, creative geniuses generated innovative ideas. Practical engineers partnered closely with them to turn concepts into contraptions, and collaborative teams of technicians and entrepreneurs worked to turn the invention into a practical product. You believe in that ecosystem, and you refer to the ecosystem again and again, that genius and then the practical engineer and then the process of collaboration. Babbage and Lovelace had their own form of that collaboration from very early on, didn't they?
Right. He called her my muse. You know, we shouldn't overstate her. She was, in some ways, not as great of a mathematician as she would like to have believed, but she could generate and understand the sequence of Bernoulli numbers and make a chart for them that becomes the first published program. And whenever somebody disparages a bit, this is Ada Lovelace Day, so we should all celebrate it. Yes. I say, okay, tell me the 7th and 8th and 9th in the sequence, or 10th, 11th, and 12th, of Bernoulli numbers, and how you would do a chart on a mechanical processor like that one to generate them. And then people understand what a partnership she had and how important she was to Babbage trying to create what he thought was a numerical calculator. But she has the great insight that it's not just for numbers. You know, her mom had taken her to the Midlands of England in the 1830s to look at the mechanical weaving looms that were using punch cards. You have those punch cards downstairs in this museum. They're the punch cards for the Jacquard loom, the mechanical looms of the Industrial Revolution that Ada saw on that trip. Now, her father, Lord Byron, was a Luddite. And I mean that literally. The only speech he gives in the House of Lords is defending the followers of Ned Ludd, who were smashing those looms because they thought it put people out of work. This notion of disruptive technology isn't new. I mean, it goes back a long time. Disruption's not new. So Ada, instead of thinking, yes, these machines will put people out of work or bad, she said, oh, these punch cards, and go downstairs and look at them, they're cool. These punch cards, she has a line in her wonderful set of notes she does on the Babbage's analytical engine. She says, it will make the machine be able to weave patterns just like the loom can. And then she says, so the machine will be able to do anything that can be notated symbolically. Not just numbers, but words. It'll make music, she said. It'll do pictures. It will do patterns. In other words, it will be a computer, not just a calculator. So she's pretty awesome.
You point out that she is simultaneously maybe one of the most overappreciated and underappreciated people in the history of computing. Why is that?
Well, I think she's sort of grabbed onto sometimes for purposes. There are a lot of good books about her. Betty Toole has written two books. One, you know, has all of her wonderful letters and the great analysis book. And she's very favorable to the role of Ada. There are a couple other books. Doran Swain has done a great book on the analytical and on Charles Babbage. The most scientific book, I think, is Dorothy Stein's Ada, which does it in balance. But I think even if I can find it, even in the, you know, there's such a controversy. I kind of like controversy. You know, I'm an old journalist. You like those things. But, you know, I sort of explain, especially there's some guy who did a PhD at Harvard, and he writes, Ada was a manic depressive with the most amazing delusions about her talent. She was as mad as a hatter and contributed little more to Babbage's notes than trouble. So you do have, and this, you know, you do have people.
That's a footnote, by the way.
Yes, right, right. I do think that you don't have to overstate her accomplishments in order to just totally marvel at how wonderful it was that she saw the magic and the humanities that could be connected to the machine. And so I try, as I do in all the book, I mean, the interesting thing about the digital age is that it's very, very collaborative, and people work together. And then afterwards, they fight over who deserved the most credit. I see Al Alcorn's there, who actually helped, was the engineer for the first Pong and the Atari machines. And even now, there's sort of all these things scattering around saying, no, I did more. And you've seen that.
You see that all the time.
You see it all the time. So I try very judiciously to say, here are some of the disputes. But by the way, this revolution is so amazing, there's enough credit to go around. We shouldn't be fighting over it.
Now, we have four stories on the stage tonight. We started with Babbage and Lovelace. And the second is the Enigma machine.
Oh, that's really cool.
Which we'll talk about in a minute. And then just to take everybody through it, the Altair PC and then the Apple One. And in the middle, we're going to also talk about the ENIAC women. Let's turn now to Alan Turing and code breaking at Bletchley Park. And you do something really interesting, which is explore the magical year of 1937. You pick a point in history when everything seems to be converging all at once from many places on the globe.
Yes, you know, one of the things about history of technology or any history is that it's not totally revolutionary. We build on things like Babbage's engine, but every now and then it's a punctuated evolution and things happen. 37 is one of those years, partly because there's a combination of analytic science, like Claude Shannon figuring out information theory, and people understanding how Boolean algebra, which allows you to do logical sequences based simply on on-off switches, well, that kind of connects to the fact that they've got the vacuum tubes going now and they can make circuits with on-off switches. So at Bell Labs, excuse me, and other places, they're making these advances using Boolean algebra. And then you have Turing. Turing has many things that he does, but let's start with Ada Lovelace. Because Ada Lovelace, as I told you, said a machine will be able to do everything. We've tapestries like the loom, music, whatever. But she says there's one thing a machine will never be able to do, and that's think. It'll be humans that do the creativity. So Alan Turing says that's Lady Lovelace's objection. 100 years later, he is reading Ada Lovelace's notes and calling that Lady Lovelace's objections that machines will never think. So he comes up with a test, we know it as a Turing test, of how do we know machines will never think? And you put a machine in a room and a person in a room, you send questions in, and if you can't tell the difference after a while, there's no empirical reason to say the machine's not thinking. Now, you can have a lot of people like J.R. Searle at Berkeley say that's not a very good test. But still, the Turing test is ingrained into how we look at artificial intelligence. A movie is coming out in about 3 or 4 weeks called The Imitation Game. It's about Turing doing that test. Now, I think there are two strands of computer history, what I call the Ada Lovelace strand, which is that the combination of humans and machines will always be more powerful than just machines doing artificial intelligence alone. And that's one of the themes I try to explore in the book. It ends, by the way, with Jenny Rometty, who I know you're having, talking about how Watson and Deep Blue, the two machines IBM built, in the end become more powerful when combined with the imagination of humans. So that's the Ada Lovelace strand. Then we get to Bletchley Park. So he goes to Bletchley Park, this secret facility they have in England to break the German wartime codes. That machine there is an Enigma machine, which codes the German messages. Fortunately, I think the Polish intelligence originally captured one, and so they're able to slowly break how the code is done. But one of the amazing things that Turing does at Bletchley is figure out, along with Tommy Flowers, who knew how to use vacuum tubes and worked for the phone company over there, how you would make something called Colossus, which is the first real electronic operable computer, and they use it to break the German code. So when we argue about what is the first computer, one contender, if you're thinking it's got to be electronic, it's got to work, you know, it's got to do logical sequences, it probably ought to be digital. Colossus breaking the code that was done on that machine by Turing and the whole team there at Bletchley Park, and especially Tommy Flowers and some others.
And then there are a few other players in 1937, which you cover, and I want to bring into the drama now. There's John Vincennat and Nassoff in Iowa, and you explore the Atanasoff story in detail.
You have somebody here, I think, who has actually recreated.
We do, John Gustafson, John, who led the recreation of the...
There's John over there, cool.
Right.
And thank you, he's read part of the book. And I don't actually give credit to Atanasoff for truly building the first machine. I was kind of worried about what they would say, but John told me it was all right. I got it right in the book. And here's the argument. John Vincent Atanasoff doesn't fit into the notion of somebody who has a collaborative team. He's a bit of a loner. He thinks of this machine on a drive alone in an Oldsmobile one night where he drives all the way to Missouri where he can get a drink, you know, by the glass, because Iowa was a dry state. And he comes up with this notion of using circuits, electronic circuits, to do logical processing. And he builds one in the basement at Iowa State with just a graduate student named Cliff Berry, but he has no team around him. And they get it pretty good. I mean, it's a pretty nice little machine, but they can never fully get it working. Why? Because they don't have mechanics and engineers and the type of people you have in Tim. The punch card burner that was supposed to, it didn't quite work, and poor Atanasoff joins the Navy. I mean, it's the middle of the war. And in the end, the people at Iowa State have no idea what this contraption is, and they throw it away, which is why you have to recreate it here to be part of this museum. So in some ways, vision without execution is just hallucination. He never really executed on it, so I don't really think he could be called the first computer.
So let's turn to the one that you do talk about and you prefer in this pecking order of first computers, the one that John Mauchly, later joined by Presper Eckert, are working on at the Moore School at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, John Mauchly is typical of the great innovators of the digital age. He was somebody, he loved to go around and pick up ideas wherever he went. So, he's from Washington. His father was at the Carnegie Institution. He was one of those people who loved coming to places like this, hearing lectures, being at explorers' clubs, going to dinners. So he flits around, starting in the late 1930s, to places like the 1939 World's Fair, to Bell Labs, to Harvard, where Mark I is being built, which is a non-electronic, electromechanical computer. And he even runs into, at a lecture, this guy, Atanasoff, who says, I'm building one in my basement of my physics building at Iowa State. Mauchly gets in his car with his kid, I think like 6 years old, maybe 9 years old, and drives to Iowa State and looks at the machine and learns, takes some notes, goes back, and when he gets back to the University of Pennsylvania, he gets Presper Eckert, who's a really good engineer. He gets six women who we'll talk about who become the mathematical programmers of the machine. He has people who know how to have grease under their fingernails and build this huge room-sized machine. You've got a part of it on loan from the Smithsonian downstairs. And it is the first really working machine. It's also reprogrammable, thanks to the women. It's fully electronic, unlike Atanasoff's at Iowa State. And unlike his, it actually works. So I tend to say, if you're looking for the one that really worked, that's programmable, digital, and electronic, that's really the first computer. The one in Bletchley Park was pretty much special purpose, which was just breaking the code. This, you could have, you know, all the cables replugged. You could make it do other things. Typically, you know, we all collaborate. We all take ideas from one another. Steve Jobs goes to Xerox PARC. Bill Gates buys, you know, looks at the first Macintosh. Everybody's taking each other's ideas. And then, of course, Apple sues Microsoft. Well, not surprisingly, there was like 15 years of a lawsuit because after ENIAC is built, it becomes UNIVAC in its commercial form. UNIVAC becomes Unisys, Sperry Rand. They start enforcing the patents on it, at which point Honeywell wants to break the patents, and it goes and finds Adam Nassauf, who's retired. He says, yeah, that guy came and visited me. He took my ideas. So for 15 years, you have a lawsuit over who deserves the patents. In the end, the court ruled against the ENIAC people but didn't award the patent to anybody, which is probably correct because it was a collaborative thing.
We have a trustee, Gordon Bell, very famous figure in computer history, who calls that lawsuit the disinvention of the computer.
Right, exactly. You know, with all due respect to the lawyers in the room, it's best not to leave the whole notion of historical invention to copyright lawsuits. There's a wonderful one, of course, with Jack Kilby at Texas Instruments and Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore, who are pictured in your lobby here. They almost simultaneously do the microchip. And that's a huge lawsuit for many years. But Noyce and Kilby were both such decent people. They always gave each other the credit. And before the lawyers could settle, that suit went on and on and on appeal. Finally, Noyce and the Texas Instruments people just got together and said, shook hands and said, let's cross-license each other's patents. Let's get the lawyers out of this.
So let's go back to the ENIAC women, because it's another little-known, obscure story in computing where Mauchly and Eckert recruit these young women, mostly math majors, mostly from small Midwestern colleges, bring them all to Pennsylvania, and decide that they are going to be assigned the task of programming this computer. Why are they simultaneously so obscure and yet played such an important role at that key moment?
Partly they're obscure because this was happening during war. And ENIAC was originally done mainly to calculate missile trajectories for artillery tables. And as the war is ending in 46, the war is ending, and by 1946, they realize it has to do other things, such as John von Neumann arrives and says, I wanted to know if this hydrogen bomb concept will actually work. So it has to do the explosion and implosion for the hydrogen bomb. And women are the ones who understand how to program it by unplugging and replugging cables and turning off switches. They get written out to because, you know, the boys with their toys thought that they were in charge. And the day that they unveil ENIAC, finally, in 1946, it's February. It's Valentine's Day. The New York Times is there. There's all sorts of dignitaries from all over. And they're finally going to show off that they have this new machine. Gene Jennings, Bartik, then Gene Jennings, I think Francis, Billus, and others, They do the program. They have to stay up all night because they've got one thing wrong they couldn't figure out. They finally figured it out. It works perfectly for the demonstration. Then everybody goes to this wonderful candlelit dinner at Penn, black tie. It's in the pages of the New York Times, but the women aren't invited. And it's Valentine's Day, and they take the bus back to their apartments, feeling bad that they didn't even get invited to the dinner. So when you wonder about women in technology, you have to say, we all have to have role models. I mean, I told you about my dad.
Right.
You know, you got to put these people back in the history so that everybody feels included in this revolution and they have role models.
I think, as you know, we inducted.
Thank you.
Yeah, please, absolutely.
You inducted Gene.
We inducted Gene Bartik as a fellow here in 2008.
Gene Jennings Bartik, and you should buy her autobiography, which was published, I think, posthumously.
Yes, it was.
And it's online now. And it's just Pioneer Programmer, it's called. And here's some little thing about it that you should think about, too. She's from Atlantis Grove, if I remember, Missouri, a town of, like, 127 people or whatever, tiny town. She's one of seven or eight children, a poor farm family. And she decides she wants to go to college because her family cares about education. So for about $78 a year, she gets to go to Missouri State, Teachers College.
Teachers College.
And she decides she doesn't want to be, she wants to be a mathematician. And back then, that was fine. Women mm-hmm. could be mathematicians. So for that $78 for 4 years, she becomes a mathematician and sees the advertisement as she's graduating saying, come to Philadelphia and work on ENIAC. We need mathematicians. And she goes and becomes this pioneer programmer. That college right now costs $14,000 a year. We should not cut off this ability to allow everybody to get a good education. Anyway, read Jean's book.
Well, and she was so accomplished in her own right that she went with Eckhart and Mauchly to UNIVAC and continued her career for many, many years.
And Grace Hopper, who's the other woman pioneer programmer, she's up at Mark I at Harvard. And the good thing about Mauchly and Eckhart, they may not have invited the women to that February 1946 dinner, but they made up for it because they hired a lot of these women, including Grace Hopper and Jean Jennings Bartik, and John Mauchly actually married one of them, who became Kay Mauchly.
That's right.
But then also hired her and married her. I guess that was done back then. And she became one of the great pioneer programmers, too. And it's interesting that fewer women go into computer science now than did, 20 years ago. And that's why it's good to have Sheryl Sandberg and Marissa and others here.
There's a terrific film, if you haven't seen it, called Top Secret Rosies, mm-hmm. which is about the history of these women programmers,
terrific. You should go online and Google them, because there's a couple of documentaries that have been made, too,
about
on them.
Too.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on. You mentioned the semiconductor earlier, and I want to talk now about the transistor and the integrated circuit, but I want to talk about it to draw a contrast, the way that you explain the way teams and collaboration happen, mm-hmm. and by contrasting two very different approaches.
Right.
One is the Shockley mm-hmm. approach and his team working on the transistor on the one hand, and then Noyce and Moore in the integrated circuit on the other. Talk a bit about Shockley, the genius inventor, but the really formidable
Shockley,
personality.
Of course, you all know about a genius, but also paranoid and eventually racist. So he's at Bell Labs, which is by far the coolest place for collaboration in the 1930s and 40s. And throughout the mid to late 40s, they have to figure out how to do many things, one of which is amplify a phone signal so you can make a call from San Francisco to New York. And they need a solid-state amplifier. You can't do it with vacuum tubes. And so Shockley is leading the solid-state team at Bell Labs. I love Bell Labs because it's the ultimate of, a place-based collaboration where in the hallways there, you have this guy Claude Shannon I talked about who figures out information theory. You have John Bardeen, who's a quantum theorist. You have Shockley, who's a great physicist. But they're sharing a workspace, or Bardeen is, and a bench with Walter Bratton, who's an experimentalist. He knows how to take a piece of silicon, which, as you know, is a semiconductor that you can dope with impurities and make it conduct better or worse, and therefore be an on-off switch, therefore be a solid-state amplifier. And they understand the surface state, too, which means understanding both quantum theory but also material science, like what's happening to those electrons dancing in the surface state of a piece of silicon. And so they're doing all these things. Bardeen and Bratton almost do a call and response, like there's a librettist and a composer at a bench doing a song, as they figure out ways to make the various materials they're using into better semiconductors, and even using a paperclip to jam through the surface state. They're working under Shockley. They finally do it. Shockley has contributed many of the theories, but he's been a bit hands-off. But unlike the heroes of this book, he doesn't like giving credit as much as he likes taking credit. So he's furious when they are put on the application for the
that put on the application for the patent for it, and he insists that he be in all the press releases. He even insists, I'm not sure you can see it, that in the publicity photos he be in it. He gets to be in it. And just as they were taking this photo at Bell Labs for the publicity shot, they were all standing up. He sits down and grabs Bratton's microscope as if it's his and makes himself the center. And both Bardeen and Bratton said they hated this photograph from then on. They don't speak to each other for a while. Shockley gets eased out of Bell Labs because he's such a pain to work for. The only time they really speak is when they win the Nobel Prize and they all meet in the hotel room that evening and they're both in the same, you know, restaurant. They forgive each other. But Shockley comes out here, very nearby, starts Shockley Semiconductor, and is just as paranoid and hard at building teams. So none of the people at Bell Labs will come work with him, but he calls Bob Noyce, he calls Gordon Moore, because he's heard of these young engineers, gathers them to work at Shockley Semiconductor, but after a while, they just can't stand working for Shockley. And the pictures you have downstairs in the lobby of Noyce, Moore, and others, and those notebooks of Fairchild Semiconductor, are because Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore decided the way to run a company is not this authoritarian, bossy, you know, glory-hogging way that Shockley has been doing it. And they start Intel, where they have a room almost like this, not too far from here, just a big room. Nobody has a corner office. And Noyce puts a beat-up desk right in the center of the room along with Moore and others, and there's no hierarchy, and it invents not only the microchip, but what they invent is the Silicon Valley culture of that sort of open, non-authoritarian, non-hierarchical company.
You are listening to Walter Isaacson in conversation with John Holler from the Computer History Museum.
We had Gordon here for the 50th anniversary of the integrated circuit.
A few Woodside and just sitting there and listening to him.
Isn't that fantastic? Yeah. And someone asked him about what it was like to work for Shockley, and he said, "Yeah, it's true. He was a difficult guy to work for, but he seemed to be a pretty good judge of talent."
That's probably the only egotistical thing Gordon Moore said, and he probably didn't mean it to be egotistical, but he was right.
I don't think he was talking about himself, actually, or intending to, but it certainly got the same laugh as everybody gave us tonight. So Shockley is the anomaly in the ecosystem narrative that you talk about, and I wanted to ask you at this point, why is it that some teams that seemingly have those ingredients of the genius innovator and the practical engineer and the ecosystem builder, why do some succeed and why do some not succeed?
Yeah, well, partly you have to get it right. I mean, Shockley's big failure was not just being a jerk, but he came up with a triode-type transistor, which he kept insisting would work, and it didn't. So sometimes you just get it wrong. But usually, if you get the right ecosystem of the visionaries, the people can execute, the people can turn it into products. I mean, that's another thing, too, is that sometimes you forget that you need the business person who can turn it into a real product. And that's what you see with Pat Hagerty and others at Texas Instruments. They realize the transistor is kind of cool, but you need some products to go along with it.
Well, and you remind us all that the transistor radio not only was the perfect implementation of the technology, but it revolutionized American culture.
I love the transistor radio. It goes back to Ada Lovelace. Because it's making our devices personal, the way Steve Jobs loved to do it and whatever, not doing the Alan Turing, let's create artificial intelligence that's separate from us. And what the people at Texas Instruments, especially Hagerty and others, figured out is you had these transistors, but you need a market for them that's a true mass market. They're putting them in hearing aids, but, you know, that's an important but limited market. You know, people aren't going to buy hearing aids unless they need a hearing aid. Radios were then a shared appliance. Just like many things, you have something that's shared, like a computer, that suddenly somebody makes personal. So what they do, and they can't get RCA or any big company to do it, they finally make the Regency transistor radio, I think around 1957, and it allows you to control the dial instead of your parents controlling the dial. It allows you to take it to the beach or the backyard or whatever and listen to music. That same month, Elvis Presley puts out his first album. Now, I'm convinced, and it's not just my theory, others have written about it well, that there's a symbiosis at times to inventions. You know, rock music would have had a hard time taking off if it was only that radio in the living room that parents controlled the dial. And by the way, transistor radios became a must-have thing. I remember, I mean, I was not in 1957, but in the early 60s, getting my transistor radio. How many? It's just four transistors. No, mine has six. And you could listen to any music you wanted, mm-hmm. especially the ones your parents didn't like. And so you have that symbiosis, just like the automobile industry and the oil industry grow up symbiotically. But I think more importantly, if you want to look at the trajectory of digital revolution, it's making our machines more personal. Mm-hmm. Taking a computer, which is a big hulking thing, and finally, no, you can put it on your lap. Taking radios, taking an iPod. I mean, nobody knew we needed 1,000 songs in our pocket until Steve Jobs said, yeah, music is personal.
That's the perfect segue to our fourth story, which is the PC.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to talk about the Altair now. And, of course, the Altair story is completely bound up in the story of Bill Gates and Paul Allen.
And Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs.
And I want to talk about that because we got the Apple One over there too. But let's focus on Gates and Allen now. You write about their relationship in very detailed and very personal terms. And I wonder, when you started this book, did you intend to examine the personal relationship between Bill Gates and Paul Allen as part of the story?
Well, you know, when I talk about collaborative teams and we talk about visionaries and engineers and everybody putting in a team, often teams have at their kernel a pair, Babbage and Lovelace, you know, whatever it was, and Steve Jobs, Gates and Allen, and Pressburger Eckert, John Mockley. You can go all the way down the list, two people who worked together to form the kernel, and I mean that almost in the computer sense
sure.
of a computer operating system, the kernel of the operating system. And so I was always, you know, I talked to Bill Gates from the very beginning. I think I mentioned he was the one who said, no, make it about the PC and the internet. So I interviewed him many times and very, you know, formally for the book, a nice long interview with him in Seattle. But the really important thing is when the Altair comes along, it does exactly what we said, was it takes something that's a big old impersonal thing, i.e. a computer, that up until then, we kind of feared were going to be Orwellian. They're going to be controlled by the government and the Pentagon and big corporations. This guy, Ed Roberts, makes it something that a hobbyist can do. Now, with all due respect to the Altair, it's a pretty rinky-dink thing. I mean, it's got a few lights on it and a few toggle switches. But people went nuts because you could own it on your own. You could solder it, and you could make it do things. It didn't have any basic or didn't have any programming. So that's where Bill and Paul come in. One of the things we recovering journalists like to believe is that if you have a great product and it's like Bishop Berkeley's tree and falls in a forest and nobody hears it, you're not even sure it makes a sound. One of the cool things that Ed Roberts did was get it on the cover of Popular Electronics. He knew one of the editors there. So Paul Allen in December of that year is going through the Harvard Square newsstand, that thing right at the corner in the middle of Harvard Square, because his friend Bill Gates, who's at Harvard, and has convinced Paul to drop out and to leave and to come to Cambridge and not really do much of anything. He sort of has a job, but, you know. So he's there, and he sees this thing. He says, it's happening without us. And he grabs a copy of the magazine, and it's snowing, and he trudges through the slush to Courier House, which is Bill Gates' house at Harvard, and says, this is happening without us. And Bill, as you know, starts rocking, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He's reading this, and he's rocking. And he's right about to go to exam period. He blows off all the exams, and they sit there using the computer right next to the Mark I that Grace Hopper had done, but a PDP one and a later version of a PDP that was at the Harvard Computation Lab. And they write BASIC for the Altair, Bill Gates basically doesn't shave at this point, but Paul Allen at least can grow sideburns. So they want to figure out what to do, and they realize that Paul Allen's going to have to be the one to bring it to Albuquerque when they're making the Altair, but Bill is sort of in charge. So they decide Bill should call Ed Roberts and say we have a version of BASIC, but he should say he's Paul Allen. So he makes his voice deeper, says he's Paul Allen. Ed Roberts says, okay, bring, if you walk through the door with it, you got the contract.
Got it, yeah.
And so then Paul Allen flies to Albuquerque, and they make the first of their two really good deals, because you got to be a good businessman. They say, fine, you can have BASIC for the Altair, but we keep the rights to it, and we get to license it to anybody else. Sound familiar? Mm. It's what they do with IBM,
right,
with the operating system. And so that's why BASIC becomes the standard. The Microsoft BASIC becomes the standard.
That anecdote about you pretend you are me and talk to this guy on the phone, it's very telling, because you talk about it. There's another anecdote earlier when they're young boys really working in Seattle.
The Lakeside
high school lab. And there are four of them. They get a contract, actually, that Paul Allen becomes convinced that he can work on with another member of the Lakeside group, not Bill Gates, and they take it on, and they try to do this job for a company in Portland, and they get about halfway through, and they discover they can't do it. So Allen calls Gates and says, man, we're in trouble. I got to have you come back. And then you have this quote, I want to read it because it's so interesting. Gates says to Allen, okay, but I'm going to be in charge, and I'll get used to being in charge. And it'll be hard to deal with me from now on unless I am in charge. If you put me in charge, I'm in charge of this and anything else we do. That is a really interesting story.
And has the added virtue of being true. It turns out that way. I mean, Bill Gates was that, but it was an interesting partnership. And you see that with Woz and Steve Jobs, without leaping ahead too far.
Sure.
As well, you have to have somebody who is really the driven visionary. And, you know, Woz has been on the stage. When I came and spoke about the Steve Jobs book that you had in the clips reel, Woz was sitting right there.
Sure.
And we talked about it. And in the end, he realizes, you know, okay, well, Steve Jobs really did start driving the show. And likewise, Bill Gates really did start driving Microsoft. And he becomes, you know, more and more in charge. I try to be not judgmental about that.
Sure.
I mean, I know you should read Paul Allen's book, and Paul Allen's memoir is very good, and I think he has some resentment. But, you know, Bill Gates was pretty awesome, and he knew how to code and knew how to run a company.
Well, there are several other passages that you refer to in this section where it seems clear Allen doesn't really capitulate as much as he just says, I just understood. This was the way we could best work together. This is the way that we could actually get things done. And they seem to take their roles on and just carry them out.
Sometimes we think these partnerships or collaborations are mysterious, but then you should step back and realize that's the way, you know, we've all been through things like that. I mean, I've run CNN, Time, some other things, and, you know, you have to think, well, sometimes this is the way life is. And sometimes partnerships have a lot of tension in it, but these partnerships are very productive. And I'll tell you, the last product launch I went to for Apple, you know, very near the end for Steve, I was in the green room and there was Woz. And, you know, we shouldn't be too judgmental about partnerships that have some tension in it, especially when they create Microsoft and Apple.
Sure. That's the final relationship I want to turn to, and then we'll get into...
Yeah, one of those online is going up for auction, you know, and there's like $600,000.
You see that armed guard we have over there in the corner? That's.
I was hoping that
particular
was my...
one is not going up for auction.
Oh, darn. I was hoping that was my gift for coming. And it has Woz's signature on it. I saw it, too.
Now, of course, you told... It does. You told such a complete story in your biography of Steve Jobs. I'm wondering, in this book, did you want to illuminate anything, or did you even discover something you hadn't discovered?
A couple of things. First of all, I tell it a little bit more through Woz's contribution. Just So people don't feel gypped
you
and
do.
Feel like they
That's
have to,
very true.
You know, they've already read that chapter. But here's what I discovered it when writing about Steve Jobs, is we think that he's the great visionary and that, you know, out of his head comes Apple and all of these things. And he is a great visionary. But what he did extraordinarily well is that even though he was tough to deal with, even though he's a strong cup of tea at times and could be tough on people at times, he develops an incredible set of teams. And those teams are very collaborative. And one of the last things I asked Steve Jobs was, what was the thing that you created that, you know, you're most proud of? I thought he'd say the iPod or the iPhone or whatever. He said, no, creating a product is very hard. But creating a company that can continue to create products is even harder. The thing I'm proudest of is creating the team that became Apple. So look at the original Mac team in 1980 to 1984. I mean, half of them have been in this room, you know, from Andy Hertzfeld to Joanna Hoffman and others. All of them would say how hard it was to work for Steve, but every one of them would say, and I think that was a quote I had in the highlights reel, was,
it was.
But I would, you know, I would not give it up for anything in the world. He made me do things I didn't know I could do. And you look at all these nicer bosses, you know, in the Valley over the years, they don't have teams that stay loyal. People quit all those other companies. But whether it was the original Macintosh team or the team that Steve had at Apple, you know, in the past decade, that's an incredibly good team of people like Tim Cook who know how to execute, people like Johnny Ive who have a great feel for beauty and art, people like Schiller who know how to do software. So I discovered that Steve, besides being a visionary, he was also a team builder, and he probably doesn't get enough credit for being a collaborative team builder, because if you looked up collaboration on Wikipedia, you probably wouldn't see his picture. But in the end, he deserves credit for building the most loyal team of any computer company I know.
Now you do, lest we think, or we give people the impression we're on a journey that stops about 1986, you do a wonderful job bringing the story current, talking about the online world. This is long before the internet and the World Wide Web, and then the rise of the internet, and then the rise of the World Wide Web on top of the internet. What in that whole mix to you did you really fasten on as the story that you thought really was emblematic of that?
Emblematic of the digital revolution was the creation of ARPANET, and starting with JCR Licklider. If you have to have one or two unsung or little sung heroes, Licklider is this, once again, you know, Missouri person, aw-shucks personality, likes giving credit more than taking it. When he's doing the SAGE air defense system, and he's at MIT and other places, Lincoln Labs, BBN later, you know, he creates a notion of the interactive computer display that's easy to read, because if you're doing an air defense system, you got to know real quickly what's happening. It's got to be fast and interactive. Batch processing doesn't work. He also realizes he's got you have it downstairs too, the SAGE system. You have to have 23 of these things all over the country, and they've got to instantly connect. He comes up with a humorous phrase, the Intergalactic Computer Network. He finally gets to the Pentagon, and he funds ARPANET. Then you have these really cool people doing the RFCs on ARPANET, all working collaboratively to create the protocols for the host-to-host, you know, communications, whichever needed. And then eventually Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn, who had been, especially Vint, a graduate student doing the RFCs for ARPANET, a few years later saying, well, when you have a few packet switch networks, they need to internetwork, hence the phrase internet protocols,
right.
And they do TCP/IP together. So that's cool, but one of the things I noticed, because I grew up in this very thing, I was running new digital media for Time Incorporated, was back in 1990 or so, the internet is really big and it's wonderful, but you can't get on it if you're just a normal person. You have to be at a university, you have to be at a research lab, you have to be whatever. You can't just from home dial up. Likewise, the personal computer, most of the people who invented it, from Alan Kay to Steve Jobs or whatever, they kind of wanted it as a personal creativity tool. It was not seen as a networking tool. In 1990 to 94, something amazing happened, which is we get to interconnect our computers, our personal computers. It starts with the online services that weren't then connected to the internet, meaning the Well. Eventually, Steve Case helps take over America Online, which was a sort of flailing company started by Bill von Meister. But once again, you needed a team, like a visionary like von Meister and Jim Kimsey and Steve Case, who could implement it. And then I think it's in, I can't remember the exact year, maybe 93. It's called the Endless September, because all of you net denizens who didn't like the unwashed coming on, every September there'd be a new wave of people who got to come on the internet because they went to college and all of a sudden they get on the internet. And that was called the September problem, because they'd all come on and post on the bulletin boards and Usenet groups stupid things. And eventually they would get their netiquette straight and be okay. AOL, because of Al Gore, because, you know, we all make the joke.
I promise you tell
but
that
Al
story.
Gore in the 1992 Gore Act in 93 allows the internet to be opened up to online services. AOL and Delphi are the first two to do it. I remember it vividly because suddenly, you know, we could go on AOL and then have an open gate to go onto the internet. And it was called the Endless September because from then on, all these people start flooding onto the internet. But it is a really good thing. It allows the internet, to get back to the theme of the book, to become personal, mm-hmm. to become something the rest of us can use.
You match that up to the cultural transition that, yeah. that Holocaust almost we were going through with everybody, all the turmoil in the United States and the mm-hmm. Complete upheaval of social norms and campus unrest and yeah. the idea that information was really going to be free and everyone needed to be a part of that, and that this marriage of online and computing really played right into that.
Yeah, and it happens right here. I mean, this is the epicenter. I guess I shouldn't use earthquake. This is the G spot,
Thank
or I should
you.
Find
yeah,
some,
right.
better,
no,
some better yeah. locus term for it. And it really begins in the 70s and all the way through. And this is a long section of my book that I actually crowdsourced. I put this book online, I put these passages online, and people like Stuart Brand and Dan Bricklin and many others, Liza Loop, who I'd never met before, but it was a community organizer in the 70s. I put it on a site, Medium, and some other sites where you could actually put notes and add things in. So these chapters became crowdsourced by the people who were involved. And there was a whole melding of tribes. And I really would go back to the 70s for that happening. But you have right here, the electronic geeks, the people from the defense industry, the people wearing their pocket protectors from Hewlett-Packard. But you also have the Whole Earth crowd that believes in access to tools. Stuart Brand, like every few years, is doing something really, really cool. He actually online helped edit this chapter. And then you have the anti-war activists who want to, you know, spindle fold or mutilate. You know, that became an ironic anti-war statement of that we don't want the corporations to own our machines. You actually have the hippies, Ken Kesey and the acid test, and out of that comes Stuart Brand and Doug Engelbart doing the mother of all demos. So there's a cauldron that has as its one common flavor, anti-authoritarian, let's take the tools back, let's make the tools personal. And that's when the personal computer arises, and then the notion of switchboards, bulletin boards, online services, the Well, and eventually the World Wide Web.
I want to close with the return to the theme that you sounded earlier. You credited Steve Jobs with it. It's very much an original idea for you, the way that you're talking about it these days. You gave the Jefferson Lecture this mm-hmm. summer for the National Endowment for the Humanities, and you talked about in great detail that intersection of the humanities and technology. And it's a theme you're really beginning to explore. I wonder if you would talk a little bit more about
that. Yeah, I mean, the book begins with Ada, and it ends with Ada. And it ends with Ada forever, because her vision of the combination of human creativity and machines has turned out to be more powerful even though someday we'll hit the singularity and you can invite all the people back who have predicted it, but it's always 20 years away and it's always 20 years more away, whatever. But in the meantime, the connection of human creativity augmented by the power of machines, as Doug Engelbart and others said, has proved great. And you can even to today, I mean, the end is of the book is with Google. The Google algorithm is not just some computer algorithm. It's a computer algorithm that also connects to the individual human judgments, millions a day, made by people who put links on their web. So it's a combination of human creativity and computer processing power. When you have Jenny Rometty here, ask her, what are they using Watson for today? To collaborate with doctors. What are they using Deep Blue for? Kasparov is having teams in which the computer and the human can always beat either the best human or the best computer. So I believe in that. And at the heart of that vision of Ada Lovelace is that if you're going to connect humans to technology, you have to connect the humanities to the sciences. You have to feel comfortable with both. That's what Google is all about. That's what Justin Hall creating blogging is all about. That's what Ev Williams, when he does Blogger and then Twitter, but now Medium. Medium, his new platform, that isn't just about computer platform. It's about connecting it, making it more intimate and more personal. Alan Kay got that vision at Xerox PARC. One of the ultimate people ever, Steve Jobs. Make it personal. Make it so, and you know, stand at that connection of the humanities and our technology. So maybe someday there will be a singularity in which the machines won't need us and they'll leave us behind. Lord Byron felt that. He was there with Mary Shelley when they wrote Frankenstein's Monster, you know, which is the great sort of theme of that. But I've always believed that those who feel comfortable at the intersection of the humanities and the sciences are, like Steve Jobs, the people who are going to be the most creative.
So. We like our authors to read a little bit in their own voice, and let's close, if we could, with that.
We humans can remain relevant in an era of cognitive computing because we are able to think different, something that an algorithm, almost by definition, cannot master. We possess an imagination that, as Ada Lovelace said, quote, brings together things, facts, ideas, conceptions, in new, original, endless, ever-varying combinations. We discern patterns. We appreciate their beauty. We weave information into narratives. We are storytelling as well as social animals. Human creativity involves values, intentions, aesthetic judgments, emotions, personal consciousness, and a moral sense. These are what the arts and humanities teach us, and why those realms are as valuable a part of education as science, technology, engineering, and math. If we mortals are to uphold our end to the human-computer symbiosis, if we are to retain a role as the creative partners of our machines, we must continue to nurture the wellsprings of our imagination and our originality and our humanity. That's what we bring to the party.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Walter Isaacson, President and CEO of the Aspen Institute, in conversation with John Holler, President and CEO of the Computer History Museum. This program was recorded at the museum in Mountain View on October 14, 2014. Major funding for this program was provided by the Intel Corporation. The recording engineer was Jim Bennett. The engineering supervisor was Monte Carlos. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening.